Lima, Coast to Coast, Show 43, October 6th, 2007. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. Before getting into the show, I'd like to remind the listeners there are four ways to contact it. First is via the web at www.thelemacoasttocoast.com. Second is via email at podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com. Third is via voicemail at 206-350-1897. And the fourth way is via MySpace at www.myspace.com/ThelemaCoastToCoast. Notice the mailing address is no longer valid. Why? Because I'm now moved and settled in Amsterdam, so my P.O. box in the U.S. will be of little use to me. As such, the postcard promotion is at an end, too. I think I mailed out the stickers to all those who sent postcards before I left in August, and if I didn't, I apologize. There's little I can do about it now. Also, at the time of the move, I changed the website to a simpler format, that of a blog, because my hosting was changing and I wanted to make the interface a little easier. Those familiar with the WordPress application will recognize the format. Feel free to go to the site and leave comments. Feedback is always appreciated. I hope to add more functionality to the site in the near future. Also, I plan to be answering listener mail right on the site itself, although I'll be refraining from using any names other than maybe the first name or so, like I have done on the podcast in the past. This doesn't mean I won't be answering listener mail on the podcast also, but I think this is just an added feature of the new format. As I mentioned before, I'm now moved and settled in Amsterdam and in my classes, and the material is fascinating. I really will not be mentioning it much on the show, but I write often on my blog about it, which is at www.thelema.nu. That can also be reached at thelema.com, thelema.us, thelema.info, and thelema.biz. There you can find essays about Thelema, Crowley, magic, my school, and my personal thoughts and more. It's updated a lot more than the podcast, so I encourage people to go out and check out my blog and interact on it. Also, there'll be links to pictures and other things. I have a Flickr account that I add lots of pictures to, so you can get a more visual idea of what's going on in Amsterdam and my schooling also. So, I'm finally glad to get the new show out to you all. It's been just over 3 months. I want to thank all those who sent emails and messages on MySpace and encouraging the next show. The continued support is really appreciated, because things are getting... Because things are just getting reestablished, I'm not going to be reading any listener mail today, but encourage the sending of it. Also, use voicemails. I love getting them. Now, because of the move, I have changed my primary interview system. I'm now using Skype a lot more than the phone. The good news is that the guest does not sound like they're in a tunnel, and, usually. But my microphone, unfortunately, is a bit problematic. I'm going to be working on this, but in the meantime, I apologize for the high pitch my voice carries in the interviews. Speaking of the interviews, I have three for this show. First is with Nikki Hughes. She is one of the organizers for the UK Gnosis Festival, taking place at the end of November. She tells us about the origin of the Thelemic Festival and what it's all about. Then I have a discussion with Keith418 about Thelema. Is it a religion? And if not, what is it? And lastly, an interview with David Rankine about the new Golden Horde book, The Goetia of Dr. Rudd. We talk about the book, Goetia, and much more. I hope this revival show will have something interesting for everyone. So without further ado, here is Nikki to tell us about the Gnosis Festival.
We have Nikki Hughes on the phone. Nikki is a volunteer organizer for Gnosis, a Thelemic gathering that takes place in Northumberland, England. Are you there, Nikki?
I am.
Welcome to the podcast, 93.
93.
So for those who don't know about Gnosis, and I have to admit, I've only learned about this recently, this is a Thelemic gathering that's been going on a number of years in England. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about how this got started and what takes place?
Sure. We got started about 5 years ago. My husband and I were visiting another group of Thelemites in Sweden, and we spent a most wonderful weekend away there, and we'd gone up to the top of a very rickety tower, and there was a group samech, and we were just standing at the top of the tower after the ritual, just taking in the ambience of the whole thing, and we were just like, we really, really want to take this out to a much wider community. We don't want people to have to travel all the way to Sweden to get this. And that's when the idea for Gnosis was born. The following November, we ran our first Gnosis. And what we do there is we just get people who are like-minded together, and we have rituals, workshops, loads of food, loads of dancing and events. We have a fantastic storyteller who comes along and tells us marvelous stories about whatever the theme for that year is. Each year we kind of try and theme it along sort of to Thelema and something else. So the first year was like Thelema and ritual magic. And we really sort of explored Gnostic mass and a lot of the basic Thelemic rituals. We've also done Thelema in Egypt, where we had all kinds of different Egyptian cooked dishes, and we had Egyptian belly dancing. So that's kind of what it's about.
And what's this year's theme?
This year's theme is Devilish Delight, so we're hoping to do things on the Dune. We're also hoping to do some stuff on the Goetia, and we're also trying to sort of get a really carnival theme going for this year. As you might know, if you look at the Thelemic year, it's 415, so it's the Emperor and the Devil, and that's where the Devilish Delight comes from.
Well, that sounds very, very good. Now, this is a Thelemic gathering. Is this associated with any particular group?
No, we have people from all kinds of backgrounds come along. While most of the people there would define themselves as Thelemites, we even have people who just have no interest in that kind of thing or even any interest in magic turn up just for the sake of the math ball and the fact that you're basically getting to stop in a 13th century castle in England and have the most fantastic time, meet some really interesting people. And we've been so lucky to have just a really, really friendly group every year. We've not really had any trouble with people coming in and just, you know, destroying the ambience. So it's mostly about just meeting friends and about the current rather than it being, you know, like, we are Thelemites and you will do as we say.
Okay. Now, you just said it was a 13th century castle. What castle is this?
The castle's called Featherston Castle. You can look it up on the internet, just stick it in Google, and you'll see that it was originally built, as I said, in the 13th century. And the gun room, where we do most of our events on the Friday night, where the storytelling takes place, that's part of the very original part of the castle, and it's been extended all the way through right up into the early 1800s. And there's so many fabulous rooms in it. It was previously used as a boarding school just before the current owner bought it. And you've got a lot of dorm rooms that people sleep in. It's youth hostel style accommodation. So, you know, don't come expecting to like sleep in a palace. And you've got three massive rooms that we do the events in. You've got the gun room downstairs, which is just filled with sofas and has a gigantic fireplace where we have a huge roaring fire for the whole weekend. You've got the blue room, which is blue, strangely enough, and beautifully decorated on the ceiling with all this sort of wood paneling. And then you've got a ballroom, which is sort of the biggest room in the castle, which we can use for the large ritual event.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the logistics. What is the date of Gnosis?
Gnosis this year is starting on Friday the 23rd of November, and it'll run through right through to Sunday the 25th, leaving Monday morning, Monday the 26th.
All right. And
we don't actually run anything on the Monday morning. That's just for packing up and cleaning up and getting out.
Right.
But you're welcome to stay over.
And how much does it cost to attend?
It's £80.
Okay.
And that includes all of your accommodation and all of your food.
Okay, so you don't have to really bring anything. You just kind of show up with your stuff.
Yourself, some alcohol.
Oh,
we don't have a license, so bring your own alcohol.
Oh, it is BYOB. Okay. And you said you're supplying the food. I assume there's different kinds of meals, vegetarian or vegan, things like that.
We cater for absolutely everything. I mean, vegans with nut allergies, that's fine, you know. So long as you let us know before you come, we will cater for absolutely anyone.
All right. And when does it start on Friday? At what time?
You can arrive any time after 6 p.m., and the rituals and that kind of thing usually kick off around 10.
Uh-huh. And then you said it goes till Monday morning, so you probably get out 10 or 11 Monday morning.
Yeah, we have to be out of the castle by 12 o'clock.
Okay. And for those who are outside of England who would be flying in, is there assistance to them for transportation or anything like that?
What we normally do is if you get in contact with us by email, then we'll set you up. If you're coming from abroad, quite often people don't just want to come on Friday and go on Monday, so we'll find you someone to stop with and tell you where your nearest airport is, things like that. And we'll arrange lifts with people who are coming from nearby. We don't run a minibus or anything.
Right.
But the castle's not difficult to get to. You can get there by rail quite easily.
Oh, okay. And about how many people show up every year?
We usually have between 30 and 50 most of the years we've run it.
Uh-huh.
I think it's actually about 48 was our maximum, and we need 30 to run the event. So
okay.
That's our minimum.
And this year, how many, do you have a number of people that have already prepaid? Does it look like it's going to be a very
we do.
Good number?
I mean, this year we've got, given that normally around this time, we don't see many deposits or anything like that. We're doing really well this year. We've got nearly 20 people booked up saying they're definitely going to come. And we've got, that's, you know, actually paid us money. And we've got another 10, 15 people who seem very interested.
And is there a deadline to RSVP and or pay your fees?
Sorry?
Is there a deadline when people need to pay or inform you they're attending?
We want everyone paid up by the end of October, if at all possible. But if you don't find out you can come until October 5th, we're not that strict. Send us your money.
Okay. All right. Well, then, if people wanted to attend or have any questions or anything, how should they get in touch with you?
Best way would be to email us. Our email address is Gnosis. That's G-N-O-S-I-S. At Gnostic Gnome, GnosticGnomes.com.
All right, and I'll put that in the show notes. Well, is there anything else that people should know about Gnosis?
Just that it's the most fun you can have with either your clothes on or off, and we have had plenty of both at the castle, and that it's, we've had the most positive feedback of it from all the attendees we've had in the past. So I think that if you do come, you will have a fantastic and memorable time.
Well, great. Well, thanks for being on the podcast and letting people know. You know, in the past, the podcast has been generally North America-centric. So I wanted to make sure that since I'm here in Europe, that I let people know more about what's going on in Europe. So thanks for being on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. 93.
Thanks to Nikki for being on the show and telling us about the Gnosis Festival. Unfortunately, because of my schedule, I will not be able to attend, but I wish I could. I hope Nikki or somebody else who attends the festival can send an email and tell the listeners about it after it's done, and maybe even have a link to pictures. Moving on, the next discussion is with Keith418 about Thelema and looking at whether Thelema is a religion or not. This is a meaningful topic in the Thelemic community because how one envisions Thelema as a religion or a philosophy or something else determines significantly how you approach the practices and material and also how you approach Crowley. I hope this discussion will give the listeners a little to think about and whether or not calling Thelema a religion is a good idea. Here's the discussion with Keith418.
We have Keith418 back on the podcast. How have you been, Keith?
Oh, I've been great, Sean. Thanks for having me, 93.
So in the months that I've been in transition, it appears that there's been a big debate arising in the Thelemic community about whether or not Thelema is a religion, or is it a philosophy, or something in between, or something entirely different. What are your thoughts about that ongoing debate right now?
Well, I think it's fascinating. I think it's been really helpful for the community and for those of us who are interested in thinking about the community and thinking critically about the community to look at that particular question and how it sort of spins off into a variety of other issues and concerns. I was talking with a friend today who pointed out that what he finds compelling about this debate is how irrational a lot of people are when it comes to discussing it. On the one hand, some of them vigorously insist that Thelema is a religion, and then when Crowley, of course, tells people in Magic Without Tears that calling it religion can lead to what I think he says is a stupid kind of mischief, they don't really want to look at why he discouraged people there from calling Thelema a religion. And their lack of interest in actually confronting that position of Crowley's, his position late in life, is revealing. And I've seen people say, yes, it's a religion. And then when asked to define what a religion is, they say, oh, well, there really isn't a good definition. And you're never going to come up with a really good definition of religion, which then leads me to wonder, well, if you can't really use the word accurately or come up with a decent definition, why is it so important to go around telling everyone that Crowley was wrong in Magic Without Tears and that Thelema is really a religion? And other people have suggested to me that by calling Thelema a religion, people will take it more seriously because people have been trained to take religion seriously. Other people have argued that it's a really bad idea to call it a religion because this puts it in the same sort of position as religions that most intelligent Western secular people see as superstitious and silly. So the American leader of the OTO, Sabazius, is very, very adamant that Thelema is a religion, and he said so at his speech in the recent Notocon meeting. And I think that's interesting, too. So there's a number of ways of looking at this. I kind of wonder why people aren't as invested in defining Thelema as being, at a guess, 90% self-discipline, which is another quote from Magic Without Tears that people don't seem that interested in looking at. And I very rarely see anyone referencing this in terms of online debates, I guess because if you're overweight and can't quit various habits and have the sort of problems that people in the occult community and specifically in the OTO tend to have, then it's kind of not very helpful to have your religion being about the sort of self-discipline that you find very difficult, if not impossible, to do. And I've often challenged people to say, is this really a self-disciplined community? If Thelema is 90% self-discipline, are the Thelemites revealing Thelema as self-discipline in their own lives? And if they're morbidly obese and still leaders of the OTO or have all of these self-discipline problems, what does that really tell us? And I don't see the self-discipline angle being as popular as the religious angle. Now, one of my friends also pointed out, and I think with some degree of humor, that any idiot can be religious. If you look around religious communities, they seldom discriminate based on intelligence. So if you want a huge number of people to be active in your religious group and you tell them, oh, don't worry, you don't need to be particularly self-disciplined or very smart, you just have to be religious, then that's going to be popular. At the same time, I think other people have raised, I think you, I would put in this category, have raised some very interesting questions regarding, well, if it is a religion, then how good are we at it as a religion? And I think that that's a really interesting way to approach it too. Do we treat it seriously like other religions treat their religions? Do we, you know, have trouble doing things that other religions simply take for granted, like owning property or, you know, having people who are leaders make serious commitments? These are all, I think, you know, interesting ways of looking at the problem. So I think the question as to whether or not Thelema is a religion, was Crowley wrong in Magic Without Tears or not, is a very interesting question. The other thing that's come up out of this debate is, and I think this is tremendously healthy, is people looking at sociological work and the history of the sociology of religion, you know, beginning with people like Max Weber and then going on to Niebuhr, and then there are people like people who are influenced by them, like Rodney Stark and Yannicone, who I think we've discussed before on the podcast. And that entire, you know, way of looking at religious groups from a claimed scientific sociological perspective has been, you know, inordinately helpful, because if people are right and this is a religion, then the sociologists who study religion may have a lot to teach us. And as we've looked at the Stark and Bainbridge material, looked at the Yannicone material, you know, looked at Max Weber and other writers, I encouraged people years ago to go look at Max Weber's famous book on the Protestant Reformation and the development of capitalism. I think that this has tremendous opportunities it offers us to examine the Thelema community in new ways. Now, unfortunately, for people, you know, sort of committed to a diehard defense of the OTO and its stumbling leaders, the more you look at the sociology, the less good they look. I mean, it's not happy making for those defending the OTO, because oftentimes sociologists studying new religious movements or cults and cult and sect formation often have very biting and very painful things to reveal about ourselves and our organization and our religion, if that's what it is. So, you know, if you think this is going to be a big happy dance for the OTO, it's not going to be. At the same time, if we study this material carefully and see what it has to teach us, it might help us solve some of our problems and look at some of the ways we deal with things in a better way.
One of the things that I've noticed is that the people pushing Thelema as a religion, and in particular in the OTO, that it's very selective on what they want to push as the religion. They're not looking at the totality of the corpus of Crowley's work. So where Crowley's like, okay, let's say Thelema is religion. Are you going to do these practices? So for instance, you have Liber Astarte, where you know, you're actually doing very intense religious worship, but you're doing it in a way that is personal and non-congregational, which it seems that the people pushing Thelema as a religion are looking to have big congregations of everybody feeling good. Also, you have a lot of practices that are transgressive, things like idol worship, or various practices that are difficult, you know, memorization or self-analysis, things like that. Those kind of religious practices that are in the Thelemic corpus are totally being just ignored. And instead, you get kind of this, well, Thelema is a church and the Gnostic Mass is what it's all about, and everybody can feel good and go to Mass and have their cake and wine and go away from that. And it seems to me that that whole thing is pretty limited.
Well, I think there's any number of ways of looking at these sorts of issues. And, you know, one of which is, and I've written about this, is if you talk about religion, most of us see it as worship. It's hard for us to disassociate the idea of worship and religion. And if there are elements of worship involved in Thelemic praxis, which I think there most certainly is, you know, how do they work within the realm of Crowley in the 40s telling people, well, it's not a religion, don't think of it that way. And there's a lot of ways of looking at this. And I've referred people back to Liber Astarte in particular, because to me, it seems if you're interested in union through devotion and attainment through devotion, and attainment through worship and devotion, that Astarte is where you would want to go to look. And Crowley lays out very strict parameters as to how to perform this sort of yoga work. And he also criticizes it and offers up some basic caveats. And, you know, one of them is the suggestion that love is blind. And I read this when I was going back through Astarte recently, and I thought it was really funny because one of the books Crowley asks people to read to sort of prepare themselves for the very intense emotional commitment that goes into an Astarte working is Romeo and Juliet. And when people have told me, you know, I did this working or I performed Astarte, I always ask them, did you go and read Romeo and Juliet? Because when I did my Astarte reading, I read every book on the list, and one of them was Romeo and Juliet. And I thought it was really funny to be, you know, not out of high school, not, you know, obsessed with Shakespeare and sitting there, you know, in my friend's apartment in Oakland reading a Folger Library edition of Romeo and Juliet. But the thing that, that Crowley comes back to is that love is blind. And if you become consumed with religious devotion and the emotion that goes into that, it has a blinding effect. And I've thought about that in terms of the way it's so difficult for people to look at the is it or is it not a religion argument, because many of them seem incapable of having what I would say were measured, dispassionate, reasonable speculation conversations about it, and instead seem very committed to saying, you know, yes, it is, or no, it's not. And they get very emotionally engaged in it. And Crowley is telling us this is the problem with this particular form of yoga, is that it is dependent on emotions, and emotions can cut off your ability to think skeptically and rationally, which may be one of the reasons why ultimately he didn't want people to think of Thelema as a religion in the 1940s, because he saw that the more they thought of it that way, the more emotional they got and the less they were able to, you know, engage in critical thinking and a sort of objective mindset. So that to me is really ironic and is something that I think people should look at. On the other hand, you know, one of the ways I think you would ask is there's this intense devotion that goes into Astarte and this intense commitment, so intense that Crowley is warning people against self-mutilation and dangerous practices that they may be tempted to in the course of their absolute commitment to the deity that they have chosen. And you're kind of turning around saying, if everyone is so obsessed with religion and this sort of back to yoga kind of approach, where's the effort and involvement and engagement and passion that he's talking about here? And if it is a religion, aren't they kind of pursuing it in a half-assed and lame way? And that, I think, is a very apt criticism of the people in the OTO in particular who, you know, to my mind, you know, don't really make that kind of deep commitment at any point. And in terms of memorization, you know, the leaders right now have been really working to get people to memorize the mass, memorize the rituals. But the real passion and devotion that lasts an entire lifetime and is very deep and very meaningful and produces great art and great writing and architecture and a really solid community, I don't really see that there.
No, I think you're absolutely correct. And that's kind of the problem. The one thing that I have noticed, though, is there is an intense love that seems to be prevalent within the masses of the OTO, and that is kind of their love for the group, and especially the love for the leaders and the unquestioned devotion. So if you attack the leaders or you criticize the leaders, all of a sudden, you know, you're attacking their god. You're attacking their identity. You're attacking that which they love. And then they turn around and they, you know, act vehemently against you. So I think we do see it in a strange kind of way. It's the worship of the herd. And it is the herd of the order.
A friend of mine talks about this, and I think some sociologists have looked at it too. They wonder, you know, why do people engage in religions, and why do people, especially in modern times, join religious groups? And a lot of sociologists say that it boils down to exchanging affect. That this is the thing that they keep looking at. You know, people join to have certain answers given. They join, you know, to get compensation for the rewards that they're not able to get in real life, whether they fall short of those rewards or because the rewards the religion offers are rewards no one can have in real life. They're, you know, eternal life, which is not something any of us can really attain to, according to scientists, in real terms, in real life. So they go looking for these compensations, and the exchange of group affect and getting into a warm and loving community is one of the things that some sociologists think is the major reason that people get involved with religions to begin with. And you can debate whether or not that sociological model is correct or whether the exchange of affect among groups is the most important thing. But I look at this and I sort of say, how does this sort of corporate worship and, you know, herd values and you know, it comes under the guise of, oh, you know, our fraternity is so great, or we're experiencing this fraternity or whatnot. How does that kind of work with what Crowley is telling us in Magic Without Tears, which frankly is very down on group activity in general? And yeah. I think this is kind of the elephant in that particular book that's sitting in the living room that no one really wants to talk about, because he's not very enthusiastic about group work at all at that point.
No, he criticizes it and says, you know, you get people together and they start criticizing their hats. And,
right.
You know,
and they
basically become petty and they don't actually concentrate on the work.
Right. He also claims that they sink to the lowest common denominator, that no matter how elevated the group is, it sinks to the level of the lowest person there. And I look at this and I'm like, well, okay, how do we rectify that with the current, you know, interest in group activities and group workings and so on? And I don't know. I mean, to me, it seems like the OTO is slipping backwards, you know, via its needs for its herd values into a sort of, you know, old Aeonic, the group comes first, and, you know, put your critical thinking aside and support what the group wants, and you know, sacrifice the individual on behalf of the group. And again, you know, Crowley is telling us in Magic Without Tears, hey, selfishness is the way it's at. You know, you want to be selfish. Selfishness is not a bad thing. And so I ask people, you know, as a selfish individual, what are you getting out of X, Y, or Z event? And if, as a selfish individual, you're getting a lot out of it, then that's great. Don't let us rain on your parade. You know, have a good time. But if you're sitting there not really getting too much out of it and thinking that it's lame and it's not really doing what you think it's supposed to do, then don't feel obligated to continue to support it or feel that you have to turn off your critical thinking skills if it's got some problems. And again, you know, I kind of feel that dispassionate sort of attitude. I mean, I keep coming back to this thing where in Astarte, where he talks about self-mutilation. And I kind of feel that people in the OTO have mutilated their critical thinking skills and their judgment in order to pursue this sort of half-assed Astarte of Thelema as a religion, where they can't really think about it critically anymore because they've mutilated their ability to do that. And that's really, if that's true, that's really sad. But when you see the great reluctance and fear people have to voice what they really think, what other conclusion can you really come to?
Right. Or what's worse is they become hypocrites and say one thing publicly and the, you know, another thing privately.
Yeah. Yeah. We see this all the time, and it's very sad. And it's, again, the more people get away from the Crowley material, I think, and the more they start adopting conventional values and attitudes, the more this sort of thing comes into play. And again, you know, I think in a lot of ways, worshiping Crowley is safer than trying to emulate him or study him. He, you know, if you worship him, you kind of keep him at a distance. And that sort of intense passion people feel for their leaders, a lot of times, I think, happens because they see the leader sort of protecting them from Crowley. If you have a leader in the OTO who's an authority who seems, you know, like a nicer guy and a better person and less threatening than Crowley is, then you're going to love that person and see him as a protector almost, protecting you from the scary and dangerous, transgressive and unhappy making things in the Crowley corpus. On the other hand, you know, if you have somebody who's telling you, no, you've got to get over your fears and really confront the things that are bothering you the most in the material and make a commitment to it despite the fact that it, you know, seems really scary a lot of the time, and that's too bad, then that person becomes a threat too. So, you know, I sympathize with people that feel that way occasionally, but, you know, it seems to get sillier and sillier the more we look at what they're really doing.
Well, something you just said is really interesting, because when you're saying, you know, the worship of Crowley, it's almost as if they're setting up this Neoplatonic duality in which Crowley is kind of like the form or the perfect, and they feel that they never can actually reach that level, and so they put him up on this kind of pedestal and actually kind of deify him. And that just seems to me the antithesis of what Thelema is all about. Crowley, you know, maybe he did say, I am Thelema, but that doesn't mean that, you know, he was unattainable or that he is the end-all be-all of Thelema.
Well, what you're seeing too is an influence, I think, of a certain current within the Thelema community, which I think is pernicious. I think it's very dangerous, but it sort of sets up a problem for people where they cling so much to orthodoxy that we're the orthodox AA or we're the orthodox OTO and we're the ones that are right and we're the ones that are following what Crowley really wanted. And if they produce material that is cognate and consistent with Crowley, it's completely boring. It's redundant because he already did it and there doesn't need to be any new material that's just going to confirm it because that's boring and not interesting. So they don't really produce much work. On the other hand, if they produce something original or something different or something that goes, you know, beyond what Crowley did or in some, you know, different way, then they are heretics and, you know, challenging the orthodox way of looking at things. And that's bad, too. So they've kind of, you know, they've worked themselves into a corner where they can't really replicate Crowley's stuff. They can't really replicate Crowley's stuff because that's redundant and they can't do anything new because that's heretical. And that current tends to exist on a very elevated plane among certain, you know, so-called adepts, and it trickles down to the hoi polloi in the OTO who are not, you know, very advanced magically, but who nonetheless imitate that either indirectly or because of an occult current or however you want to look at it. But that's kind of the problem that they've got themselves worked into. And you know, to a certain extent, I sympathize with their plight because on the one hand, you know, you have people who are out there saying that they are doing all of this original magical work. And when you look at it, it's puerile trash that is instantly forgettable. I mean, I encourage people to go back to the 70s and 80s and look at all the groundbreaking, wonderful, amazing magical work that was being done in like 1985. And it's absolute nonsense now and no one cares about it and no one pays any attention to it and no thoughtful, you know, really deep person thinks that it's very important at all. So the people making these claims about surpassing Crowley and coming up with this new and original work are often really, really lame. And we should be critical of their claims. At the same time, unless you're really trying to do the material and you know, really confront it as an individual, you know, you're stuck in this worshiping Crowley mode, which, you know, I can live my normal life and worship Crowley, and I can get the benefit of being a Thelemite and not take any of the real risks from it, which I also think is a major selling point of the Thelema as a religion thing. It doesn't seem very risky to me. It seems like converting Thelema into something that, you know, average middle-class contented people are going to find acceptable and, you know, a nice little slot in their lives. I mean, one of the questions that I've looked at recently too is if Thelema isn't a religion, you know, what is it? And one of the things that occurs to me is it an ideology? And if you look up the dictionary definition of an ideology, I think Thelema fits that definition more than it does a religion. And, you know, Crowley wasn't telling people not to call it an ideology. Maybe he wasn't really familiar with that term. It didn't have the same kind of use then that it does now. And I have friends who argue with me about the use of the term ideology in this context too. But to me, an ideology is much more threatening than a religion because the ideology of the West that we all live and work with basically says there's a place for religion in your life. It can't get out of that place and it shouldn't, you know, try to take over your life, but there's a place for religion in your life. And so the people in the OTO sort of, to me, are often making a deal with the larger ideology of the West, which is we accept your values, we accept your way of looking at the world, we accept your claims. This is our religion, and we're making a case for it to be slotted into the same place that other people slot their religions. Okay? Is that okay? And here's why we're legitimate, and here's why we're non-threatening, and here's why we're not going to be a problem. So we just want a place at the table with the other religions. We don't really want any more than that. And I kind of think that's not really what Crowley wanted. Crowley did not want Thelema to be accepted as, you know, any other religion. I think he wanted a lot more than that for it. And I don't know if the current people in the OTO are ready to even look at that kind of question or whether they're up for it to be anything more than a religion when they can't even do the religion thing very well.
Well, I think that's a good place for us to stop. Thanks again for being on the podcast, and lots of people have been asking about where the podcast is, when this next one coming out, and in particular, a number of the emailers have you know, stressed that they want to make sure that you're continuing on the podcast. So, thanks for being on the newest one.
Well, thanks for having me, John 93.
Thanks again to Keith for being on the show once more. Golden Horde Publishing has released a significant number of fascinating books over the last few years. As they do, I've been quick to promote them. The first, The Practical Angel Magic of John Dee Zanukian's Tables, was mentioned on one of the first shows. The second book in the Source Works of Ceremonial Magic series, The Keys to the Gateway of Magic, was co-authored by Steven Skinner, and he came on the show to tell us about the book. Similarly, with the release of their third book in the series, The Goetia of Dr. Rudd, co-author David Rankin has now come on the show to tell us about it and share his ideas about the Goetia. Subjects like Enochian and Goetic magic seem to be very popular with Thelema Coast to Coast listeners, so I'm hopeful that you all will listen to the interview, and if you're really interested in it or practice Goetic magic, that you'll get this book. I cannot emphasize how important it is for this material to be supported. Anyway, enough of my banter. Let's get into the interview. Here's David Rankin.
We have on the phone with us David Rankin. Welcome to the podcast, David. 93.
93, John.
For those who aren't aware, you and Steven Skinner are the owners of and produce most of the books from Golden Horde Press. And you've recently come out with, I think it's your fourth book, The Goetia of Dr. Rudd.
Yep, The Goetia of Dr. Rudd's the third one in the Sourceworks of Ceremonial Magic series.
Right.
I mean, there are a few other books on Golden Horde, like Stephen's Complete Magician's Tables, and some rare sort of feng shui manuscripts he's working on as well, but the Sourceworks is the two of us together, yeah.
Okay, wonderful. Now, people are usually familiar with The Goetia from, I guess, the Lesser Key that was published by Crowley, from the work that Mathers did, and maybe some other authors here and there, also from some of the work that is being done by Ouroboros Press. They're putting out various manuscripts. So there seems to be an interest in the Goetia. Why was it that you decided to put out the Goetia of Dr. Rudd?
Well, Joseph Peterson did an excellent job with his book. Obviously, you know, his work can't be praised enough. I have a great deal of admiration and respect for what he does. But we felt that Rudd's Goetia was quite unique and deserved to be put out in its, sort of, in its full glory. Rudd had sort of turned up as a name again and again in our research when we were looking through various manuscripts for the other earlier books in the series. And indeed, the second book, Keys to the Gateway of Magic, is Rudd material, and we just felt that the uniqueness of Rudd's Goetia, with the extra elements that it brought which haven't been put into the public arena before, meant it deserved to be put out there so people could sort of see what extra additions he put in and what, you know, benefits there are to working it with those additions in it.
Now, that's one of the things that is important about this book, is it's publishing a lot of manuscript material that has never been published before and or compiled together in a complete volume.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, obviously the most noticeable thing is that Rudd paired off the 72 demons in the first part in the Goetia with the controlling Shemham Forash angels. You know, not a new idea. We see it back in the Testament of Solomon in sort of, you know, 1st to 3rd century CE. So, you know, there are a lot of precedents there for that happening. But, you know, it was something that I for years had thought about. I've no other writers and magicians have also postulated it. I mean, Poke Runyon is a good example of, you know, he came up with the idea as well. But finding the sort of precedent of it actually being in a manuscript and the dual seals to be put on either side of the Laman with the demon on one side and the controlling angel on the other, which is quite a revelation and a pleasure. And that is obviously one of the most attractive things about Rudd's Goetia, that you have this whole pairing and the whole controlling force there, which makes it easier to work with the demons when they're called up.
Now, one of the criticisms against Rudd's manuscript is the inclusion from the Heptameron.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic that people should criticize that, because both the Lesser and the Greater Key of Solomon are largely derivative from the Heptameron, as are many of the other grimoires. What Rudd did is basically acknowledge that fact and put more of the information in a more lucid way. I mean, for example, there's more information on the magic circle in Rudd's Goetia than in the other ones. So I don't think it can really be criticized when the Heptameron is clearly one of the roots of the Goetia.
Now, your kind of framing this whole book and the Goetia and in all of the various manuscripts in it, kind of looking at it in the lens of the Lamegaton and saying, okay, this is kind of like the full work, you know, the five books, and then looking at the various manuscripts and the pieces of it that are in the manuscripts that make up the Lamegaton. So let's kind of take a few moments and look at some of the manuscripts that are in there. The two main manuscripts are the Harley manuscript 6482 and 6483. And that's where you're talking about, like in 6483 is the double seals with the angel and the demon. And then also the in 6482, where it's got the nine keys and also that elaboration of the Enochian table that Rudd did. So can you talk a little about those two manuscripts first?
Yeah, I mean, 6482, the material in there, I mean, obviously there's some of that material was put up in the 80s by Adam McLean, who we spoke to before we actually went ahead with that book, just to let him know out of courtesy and to make sure that, you know, we weren't stepping on any toes. And there's an interesting range of material. You know, it's that's one of the uniqueness of those two manuscripts. They clearly run on from each other. And in 6482, the contextual material that Rudd gives, including things like the hierarchies of the angels, and with that actually blending in the Enochian spiritual creatures and where they fit in amongst the classic nine orders of angels, plus all the stuff about testing spiritual creatures, which it features heavily in Rudd, you know, testing that your angel is an angel, not a demon in disguise, and then the nine keys themselves. That manuscript is repeated in several others, which I think is clear if you look at the book, that the actual nine keys turns up elsewhere. There's some quite fascinating diaries from that period, from the, I was thinking about 1628, of, we're not certain if it's Rudd, but certainly a magician who for 5 years was working with the nine keys, and the level of phenomena experienced is quite delightful. You know, it's very much the idea that when phenomena happened, it showed that you were getting results, not, oh my God, I have to banish everything in sight, which a lot of people seem to have these days. And then 6483, I mean, like I say, there is that sort of carryover of the sort of the Shem Ham Forash, the associated verses that come in from the Psalms. And, well, it's quite a unique work in that it is so practical, which is one of the joys of the Rudd material. I mean, you mentioned the five books. Strictly speaking, we only did four because you left the notary art out. Otherwise, the book would have gained about another 150 pages. And but to make up for that, we did put in other bits we found in our research that we thought would be of interest, like things from Sloan 3824, like the spirit contract for Padiel, for example, which is quite unique as far as we know in the things we've been looking at so far, to have a Goetic spirit contract, and various other nice snippets like that, which seem to also be possibly proto-Goetic. We have toyed with the idea of producing a separate volume on the notary art, producing a separate volume on the notary art later on in the series, but that, we'll have to see how that goes.
Okay. Your introduction of about 100 pages contains a lot of historic information about the manual, who researched it through the kind of the historic continuity. It even looks at various manuscripts in the lists of Goetic names and compares them, and then goes into various practitioners up all the way to 20th and 21st century practitioners, including Mathers, Crowley, and Poke Runyon. So do you kind of consider this, you know, the major, is this kind of like the first kind of look at this in this continuity, or are there other books out there also that kind of would do the same thing or complement this?
I think that, if I remember correctly, Peterson looks at some of the editions, but perhaps not people in the same way. So it may be that we are the first to do that, but as it's, you know, an ongoing tradition, we felt it was appropriate to look at people who have been involved with publishing the editions of the book in modern times. Of all the grimoires, the Goetia is one of the ones that really seems to grab people's attention, and you know, we can see that by the level of interest there's always been in it ever since Crowley nicked Mavis's edition.
Let's kind of address that, because you're not very favorable to Crowley in your introduction.
No, I mean, Crowley's edition, I think there were a lot of flaws in it because, you know, it was early in his magical career. I don't think he fully got it, a point that was made by Alan Bennett to him. You have been dabbling with the Garisha, and Crowley denies it, and Bennett saying, well, it's been dabbling with you. I think that, you know, it is relevant to demonstrate that it does have this appeal through to modern times. And I also think it's relevant when you have people who are doing stuff to push the boundaries, like Pope Runyon, that, you know, they be given credit for actually making the effort. So many people just want to rehash, which is not really the best approach as far as we're concerned. You know, make rare material available in the public forum, but it's also really important to make material where people are pushing the boundaries and trying out new things. And when it's people who have experience, so it's not a case of just doing what they like, but actually building on solid foundations, then I think it's very relevant to draw that to people's attention so they know they can go and look elsewhere and see what other conclusions people have come to and, you know, how that resonates for them.
In your introduction, you look at the steganographia, and, you know, there's been a lot of speculation about the cryptographic aspects of it, and was it used for spying or things like that. And you actually are presenting a very different kind of aspect. Instead of it being a mechanism for a person to talk to another person, you're saying it's a mechanism for the magician to talk to angels. Can you expand on that?
Well, I mean, you know, as the precursors probably to the Enochian tables, we sort of thought perhaps we should look more at the magic of it rather than just assuming it's purely for cryptography. You know? And when you look at it and the other material in the Lemegeton and Trithemius' influence on them, then it becomes clear that perhaps there is a bit more to it. You know, the actually with names being derived from tables, you know, the tables that encrypt can also produce names. So, as we said in the book, like the idea of instant email to the spirits, that the idea of communicating in a holy language is one that's very appealing. And of course, cryptography and sorcery do go hand in hand. It's a point we do make, you know, in the book. So I think the idea of barbarous names has an appeal going back to ancient Greece and beyond, and that, you know, we felt that Trithemius was doing more than just trying to work out ways to send messages from person to person, and that it just seemed more logical that it would be a way to communicate with directly with the angels. Funnily enough, there's a, although I may have dissed Crowley a little earlier, we can't ignore he did do a lot of fantastic work, and that's something we see in a way in Crowley's work, when the way he would test a spirit or somebody who was possessed with, you know, only giving the first letter of each word in a sentence to prove that it was a genuine connection. And that's something that, you know, Crowley took on board, and again, in my experience, seems to be quite often lacking these days, that's very present in the grimoires, this whole idea of actually testing an entity that you get and not just taking its word for it, that it's who it says it is. And so I think from that point of view, being able to communicate directly like that is very appealing.
Now, the idea, though, of kind of setting up a cryptographic message to the angels is not a new idea, you say, or maybe it's been represented in kind of more modern works by, say, like Spare, and how he takes like phrases or words or sentences and kind of turns them into a talisman.
Yeah, I mean, and then again with Spare, though, I mean, if, you know, Agrippa's Three Books of Occult Philosophy, he presents reduction sigilization. It's something that people often seem to ignore, is that that is not a 20th century technique. That is something that we see Agrippa discussing very lucidly in his work. So, you know, and again, Agrippa, like Paracelsus, you know, disciples of Trithemius. So, you know, a lot of these things have precedence a lot earlier back. But, you know, people seem to want to reinvent the wheel a lot of the time when there is actually a great deal of benefit to be had by going back to the sources.
You know, I've been reading in some other books lately, and it was talking about Johannin Alimano. Are you familiar with him? He was a mid-15th century Jewish practitioner in very he was in Italy, and he was very involved with the Kabbalah, but he, you know, going against kind of like the rabbinical thoughts, he was combining Kabbalah with magic and astrology and Platonic philosophy, and coming up with those great kind of manuscripts.
Oh, Pico della Mirandola, is that who you said? Sorry.
No. This is a different person named Yohanan Alimano.
Oh, right. No, I don't think that's not one I've really come across. It sounds interesting, though.
Yeah, he is. He saw Solomon as kind of like his prototype, you know, that he was kind of like the highest example of the Renaissance magus. You know, he had all the virtues and so forth. I mean, he wrote mostly in Kabbalistic sources or for the Jewish community. He wrote like a commentary on the Song of Songs and also wrote a book called The Desire of Solomon, things like that. But, I mean, he was also kind of doing what you're talking about, taking a lot of these sources and kind of synthesizing them. I mean, there's actually a huge history going back to the 14th to 15th century. And I'm just wondering, in your opinion, do you think a lot of these, because we're talking about all of these manuscripts that are very heavily Jewish influenced, you know, with Solomon using angels and the hierarchies of angels coming out of the Judaic tradition using Hebrew and things, but it's mostly coming from non-Jews. Do you think like the whole like historical continuity is coming from this time when there was this interaction between the Jewish Kabbalic scholars and then the Christian humanists who were kind of like fusing all of these things together in both their communities and expanding on it?
Yeah, I mean, that's something I think that was very much going on. I mean, you mentioned Italy and obviously the whole period of time there where you have the translation of the Hermetics and the Neoplatonics of people like Ficino and people like Pico della Mirandola, who I mentioned, and then going through to people like Johannes Reuchlin. It's part of that whole process. Italy, Germany, and through to France and England seem to kind of, I feel, be the center of that whole Grimoire movement. And the combination of Hermeticism, Neoplatonism, Kabbalah, all those strands weaving together, I think, obviously all find one of their distillations in the Grimoires. And so, yeah, I think they were hugely influential.
The reason I bring it up is it just strikes me, you know, because there is a section in here where you talk about Theurgia Goetia, and it just strikes me as, you know, very resonant from the writings of Plotinus and Porphyry and how all of these aspects of Theurgy or even Iamblichus, you know, how all of these aspects are kind of like reemerging, but within this Christian, Judeo-Christian context from these very kind of liberal Christian humanists who see, you know, like the Zohar and the various aspects of Kabbalah as a very literal source of revelation. But instead of approaching it in kind of like a contemplative or theological, they're you know, taking kind of the theurgia and applying the Kabbalah and, you know, coming up with these very complex systems of kind of reaching, you know, angels or like the emanations from God.
Yeah, I mean, it's much more akin, isn't it, to the Merkava tradition, in a sense.
Yes, yes, very much so. Yeah,
like a reemergence of that sort of, that dynamism, you know, a lot of the same elements, the whole periods of purification and prayer beforehand, the use of the talismans, the whole use of divine names. I think there's definitely strong echoes of Merkava, and I think the whole Merkava tradition's influence on the magic of the last 1,000 years is something that really has not been given its due attention. And it's an area that I'm looking into, and I suspect there are probably quite a lot of other people out there looking into it. And I think the influence of the Merkava into modern Kabbalah and into the Grimoire tradition is something that really has not, like I say, been given due attention at this time.
Right, because I was looking at recently some things, you know, in the debate about Maimonides and a lot of his ideas. And I think a lot of that has actually kind of seeped into a lot of the debate of that time and kind of manifested in a lot of these ideas. And I just don't think people are, aware of all of these sources, and even kind of like the Christian Kabbalistic ideas, Mather's translation of Rosenroth's Kabbalah.
Yeah,
and putting his own name on it and calling it Kabbalah Unveiled. People are not aware of where all of these syntheses, and how they were actually in the past, disparate schools of Kabbalistic thought that were kind of put all together.
Yeah, I mean, there's this amazing sort of fusion and synergy that went on from the sort of Middle Ages through into the Renaissance. I mean, at the moment I'm just in the process of preparing a talk I'm giving shortly, which is actually on sort of the Grimoire tradition as the crossroads between the magic of the ancient and the modern world. And if you go back and look at sources like the Greek magical papyri, you can see they're clearly, in a sense, proto-Grimoiric in the whole thing of calling up of various beings and series of effectively compulsions and curses and, again, use of talismans and things. This is from, 2nd century BC through to 5th century CE, the Greek magical papyri.
Right.
So, 1,000 years before, you have things like the Megaton. You can see stuff that is clearly predecessors to that work. Like you say, there's a huge amount of material there, and people are not paying attention. It's like, how far back can we go? And that's one of the things that I'm trying to do with Stephen, is trace stuff back as far as we can. Specifically, I think there also needs to be work done on, in a sense, tracing the currents back generically.
Well, that's one of the things that I've been noticing, from reading about the magical papyri of the Greeks, or then reading, about the medieval kind of grimoire tradition in this fusion of Christianity and Kabbalah, especially in the post-Iberian exodus, for when the Jews were expelled, and how they kind of had to come to terms with all of this. But them coming into Italy kind of reemerged these kind of currents and these thoughts of the Neoplatonic, theurgic, and Kabbalistic schools. But, if you go back, you still see the same kind of, like what you're saying, binding the gods in the same way of kind of the various hierarchies and all of these ideas. You can see these resident in all of the various magical traditions going all the way back. It's just it's cyclic. It's coming up in a new way, but it's just always kind of the same thing, even if it's just astrology or dream interpretation or things like
that. I mean, God, look at the Egyptian whole books of dream diaries that go back thousands of years. And then, we look at the archangels and the orders of angels, and you've got, going back to pseudo-Dionysus the Areopagite, we're talking about 5th, 6th century, where the whole nine orders of angels being established, again, many centuries before the grimoires, and then carrying on from the Greek magical papyri to the Coptic magical papyri, which are essentially much more Christian. But again, it's carrying on that idea, the barbarous words, the sequences of stuff that develops on through into the grimoires. I think, like you say, very cyclic, and perhaps we should think of it more being like the spiral. We're going around the circle and up again on the time. But the more we go back down to source, the more we can learn of where it's come from. The more the spiral you can use, obviously, the more panoramic your perspective is going to be.
But you do talk about this a bit in your introduction, because you point out on how structured a lot of these practices were, and kind of the technology. To use kind of a modern world word projecting it back. When you go over kind of the equipment that is used for the evocation and the ideas behind the circle or the triangle or the ring or the various calls or prayers, all of this kind of the wand, the seal, the vessels, this structuring that is built over time. If you go back, things were a little more less structured at times, a little more structured than others. That's kind of cyclic too. Galatia today seems to be a little less structured than what's going on, but now it's moving back towards the structure, especially as more people become familiar with these manuscripts.
Yeah, absolutely. Going off on a slight tangent from that, which I feel is quite relevant, it's interesting to think that with the grimoire tradition, the magic was generally being done with a group of people. You might have your sort of magus in charge, but he would have his assistants. And with I think a lot of the people today, or in the last sort of few decades, have been practicing grimoire magic often by themselves, which immediately puts some sort of subtle changes in context. For example, if you look at most of the grimoires, there is no altar. Everything is carried or is on the floor.
But there is a table at times.
You have the table of practice for things like D sometimes, yeah, but yeah, that's a slightly different thing. Whereas if you're a solitary magician doing something like goetic work, you're going to need an altar. So there are changes in context. And like you say, I think people are, in this day and age, preferring to actually be able to choose for themselves as to how they want to do it. If you've got all the material available, then that's going to color your choice more because you have more options and you can go, oh, yeah, okay, I think I can see why this makes sense. I mean, like, there's a little bit where, for example, there's a comment about Rudd felt that he didn't need to it's like a blessed garment from a priest or something, you know, that, which I found quite amusing, you know, when I was transcribing it. But, yeah, I think there is a bit of a move back to that slightly more formal side of things, which I'd say I'm all in favor of.
Do you think that's somewhat of a derivative of modern ceremonial magic coming maybe from the Golden Dawn in similar groups, even Freemasonry?
I think quite possibly. I think people have these days got more of a desire to, in a sense, feel they're doing it properly. So that's always been, for me, one of the differences I've noticed between ceremonial magicians and the more general pagan community. I'm probably going to upset a lot of people now, but ceremonial magicians tend to want things to be done very precisely. You know, there's no margin for error. It's not, in a sense, about any sort of feel-good factor or feeling. You can just sort of make it up as you go along. But with that formal structure there, that you want everything to be just so and just right, and that by preparing properly, you enhance your chances of success. So all of the build-up that goes into it, having all the properly consecrated tools and doing all of the work beforehand as well, is part of the process of the magic. So, yeah, I think as time has gone by, people are keener to do things, it's almost like professionally, dare I say.
Do you think that's also kind of an aspect of the heritage of theurgy? Whereas, you know, the things that are trying to go up the hierarchy seem to be more structuralized, while those who are kind of doing
thaumaturgical,
who are looking to pull down, seem to do less preparation and have less structure. It just seems to me there's a correlation between the efforts to go up and the amount of effort it is to go up versus pulling energy down.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something in that. I mean, I sometimes use the analogy of a pyramid, like, you know, base of a pyramid, a lot of work, and each level up, still a lot of work, but there's a fantastic view from the top. But if you look at that pyramid structure and the building upwards, then, yeah, you have to do a lot of work on the base. So I think definitely, you know, when you're going up a hierarchy, then you want to get it right, because if there's stones missing from the bottom, it's going to crumble down pretty quickly. Whereas if you're trying to draw stuff down, then it's down to, you know, it may or may not work, it may or may not happen, but you know, either way, if you're trying any sort of, let's face it, contact with something non-human, then you've got to be following those procedures that Rudd and others encouraged, of actually checking your contact, which of course Crowley did quite rigorously with the Book of the Law, I have to say, one of my favourite texts, just to demonstrate that I'm really not anti-Crowley. We just felt that
No. I did not think you were. But actually, let's go, since you brought up Crowley, I want to bring up one of the things that he says in the beginning of his Goetic publication, which is kind of, you know, caused some people some problems and has been given some strength to other people's ideas that the Goetia, that they're not actually external deities, that they're more psychological. Now, later in Crowley's life, he you know, very much says that they're external deities or entities or angels or demons or what have you. But he did say at the beginning of his publishing of the Lesser Key that they were psychological aspects, and a lot of people have kind of grasped onto that that statement from him. What do you think about the debate between them being psychological versus being actual real external entities?
Well, I can only base my sort of perceptions on personal experience, and I would say from my own experience, definitely external entities. And this whole thing about them just being psychological constructs, I have to just make me want to tear my hair out sometimes. You know, people tend to forget that, again, psychology is largely derived from magic, and it's still theories. It's not a proven absolute science. And so to place too much reliance on this whole thing of, oh, this is, Jung said it, so it must be true, or something like that. You know, okay. Yes, Jung said some very interesting things. Wilhelm Reich said more interesting things as far as I'm concerned, but that's something for a whole other day. So yeah, the whole that they are just sort of parts of the brain, it's painful. You know, I'd like to think that Crowley was tongue-in-cheek when he said it, but I think it has caused a lot of confusion ever since, and that's one of the few disservices that Crowley did, I think, with that little essay. It was just, it's a shame that he did it.
Well, let's go back into the introduction and look at the fact that you have a huge section that talks about the actual practice of Goetic invocation and the tools and things like that. Do you think that your publication is probably one of the most comprehensive tools for people who actually want to do this? It's got all the sigils. It's got all pictures of all of the various accoutrements that you might need. And actually the processes, the invocations, heck, you have, like you mentioned before, you even have in the appendix, you have a contract that a Goetic demon can sign that you can, you know, bind them to do something for you.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to think that there is enough people to get on with practicing there. And that's one of the things, again, that Steve and I wanted to do, is not just reproduce the manuscript, but also within the context of it, put down things about the practice and how to do it, because the manuscripts are lovely, but at the end of the day, there's also, you know, practicing what's in there. So we are sort of like trying to do that. I mean, there's another project that's kind of going on in the background, is looking more at expanding that sort of material to a much wider frameworks, but that's something that's kind of ongoing. We'll have to see how that goes.
What do you think about all of the precautions of the circles and the way that whole technology works of setting, you know, that demarcation between you and the other entity outside of it or in the triangle?
Well, I think part of it, the complexity of the circle is A, good as part of the preparation of the individual as well. But, you know, if you've done evocation and had things appear, then it's kind of nice to have something between you and them, because, you know, the first time something actually does appear is probably one of the scariest moments you're ever going to have in your life. It kind of goes into the certainty, not faith realms pretty damn quick. And from that perspective, you also tend to be actually really appreciative of, like, having a sword. Because, of course, another point about the angels and demons is that the idea that Rudd and others talk about them basically being made of like the purest form of air, and this whole idea that spiritual creatures can be hurt by iron. So your sword is the one thing that can go out of the circle, because it's not going to be able to make a connection through the iron. So, yeah, I think the preparation, like I say, it helps set the tone. It helps get you totally in the right framework, as does doing sort of, you know, purification beforehand, the bathing, the prayers and things. I mean, I had a debate with somebody a couple of years ago about this, like some people suggesting that, well, if you've got this series of conjurations, why don't you just do the strongest one? Because if you start at the first one and work through the sequence, it's implying you don't think it's really going to work. And so I sort of said, well, no, actually, think of it like this way. If you've got this demon who's not, you know, physically manifest, so it's not in quite the same plane of existence. Liken it to making a telephone call. If I call you up and you're in the bath, you ain't going to be picking the phone up on the first ring. It's going to take you a few rings to get to that phone and answer. It's the same process. You have to actually attract the attention and then allow time for the entity to get there, which is, for me, the whole purpose of the series of conjurations, for example. But the other point that came up in this argument was about saying, oh, well, you know, I'm a Thelemite, so why should I have to do all this praying and saying that I'm not worthy? But again, I think there was something that's actually psychological here, but very relevant for, as a positive use, that the purification of prayer was A, about mental preparation, but B, about avoiding ego inflation. Because ego inflation makes you vulnerable, and if you go into that situation and something turns up and just flatters, and you're more likely to make a mistake. So I think part of that whole process of prayer and making yourself not become too cocky and, you know, I am the mighty mage with the biggest wand in the universe, was actually very relevant. And I think that's one of the reasons it's actually built into the grimoire. So that's kind of a personal theory of mine, but I think it holds water.
Well, what about the fact that this is all very Judeo-Christian? You are calling upon the powers of God or Jesus or the hierarchy of heaven to, you know, kind of be your spiritual authority to be able to command these entities.
So, yeah, what you need to align to that.
Yeah, so what if you are somebody who doesn't believe in Jesus or God? Do you think you can do goetic work?
Well, I think there's that aspect there of something that actually in Terry Pratchett's book is quite relevant now. Whether you believe in the gods, it's not necessarily so important as whether they believe in you. And if they if they do, then they'll still respond. So, yeah, I don't think that you have to be practicing. Most people in the Western world are brought up in a Christian framework anyway, so even if they're not specifically practicing, there is still the fact that they, you know, they have it in the background. They're aware, you know, on some levels of a lot of the basics. And I think that, at the end of the day, with this stuff, you're generally not calling on God to manifest. You know, that's the realm of the Macabre magicians, going back to our earlier thing of actually working through the seven palaces to get into the presence of God, to the throne room. But calling on these angels, and, you know, even if they are part of that Christian worldview, they're immensely powerful entities. And they have, there's been a huge amount of energy and contact put in over a period of time. So I don't think it's a question of belief. It's a question of following a formula and a practice, and you will achieve the results. You know, whatever your initial belief might be, I think perhaps sometimes people who profess to be atheistic magicians should do evocation and start to believe in the fact that these other things do have their independent existence.
Kind of like what you said, you know, atheism is often like, you know, well, I'll believe it when I see it or show it to me. Well, if a goetic demon shows up, that's pretty pretty good indication that there's some other realm or some kind of metaphysic that you're not aware of or acknowledging.
Well, exactly. I think, you know, I was very lucky. The first group I was in formally when I was 18 or so, the guy who ran the group had a photographic memory and did evocation from memory, which was quite impressive. Just to, you know, you pick a demon, he could call it up, which was quite stunning. And, you know, the first time I saw that happen, it's one of the best steps you can ever have on your magical path, because there's never any doubt after that. It just makes you more and more determined to get better at what you do.
Well, let's tell people how to get a copy of this book if they're interested. How many of these did you publish? A good number. You made at least 1,000 of these copies.
Yeah, it was 1,500, of which 250 were leather-bound. So okay. There's 1,250 of the normal edition.
If somebody is in the United States, who should they contact to get a copy?
Well, it's now up on Amazon.com. They can get it from Magus Books, and Wiser also distributing it, Red Wheel Wiser.
Red Wheel Wiser, yeah. Or is it Wiser Antiquarian?
I think both of them, actually. But Magus Books also. And,
And then within Europe?
Within Europe, Gazelle, or they can get it off Amazon.co.uk, or from anywhere in the world, they can get it from Golden Horde.
All right. And we'll have a link directly to your website. If people have questions, can they also email you?
Yeah, I mean, we've been having people email and some very interesting discussions since the series started. There's been people around the world getting in touch with us and had some ongoing dialogues, which has been nice because, you know, there's some people who are obviously very serious about what they do, and it's been a good two-way process in that some people have brought stuff we didn't know to our attention, or, you know, given us the benefit of their experience. So, yeah, if people have questions or want to relate things that have happened, only too happy to hear.
Okay. And you said this is the third in the series. What's the next book coming out? You have on the back cover, it says, a major grimoire never before seen in print with hundreds of full-color pentacles.
That will be revealed. I'll tell you, you will be one of the very first to know. That should be out next year. That's something we're working on hard at the moment. But that is going to be quite stunning.
Well, that's great. I mean, how many volumes do you see in the source works of Ceremonial Magic?
Well, I say we're working on number four. We're also doing another book, which isn't specifically part of the series, but that we're going to do as a limited edition, which we've already referred to, which is Clavis Inferni, The Key of Hell, which is another Heptameron-derived manuscript, working specifically with the four demon princes of the quarters. And of the directions, I should say. And we have ideas for sort of books five and six, but it just depends. When we first started collaborating, when Stephen first pulled out the manuscript for book one for the John Dee's Enochian Tables, and showed me it and said, are you interested in working with me? And I went, yes, please. Then here's the guy who, over 20 years before, his book I'd read, Techniques of High Magic, got me into this stuff on a practical level. So, just from there, I went off and found another. He showed me, I think, Sloan 307, and I found the other one, 3821, or what I think it was, which is basically, again, another version of the same material. And then we also found it in the Bodleian. And so we keep looking and finding more stuff. So as long as we're finding stuff that we feel is of a high enough quality to put out there and will be of interest to people, then I guess the series will probably go on. As long as it is relevant source works. I mean, other people now are all, in the last couple of years, have also been putting out very good stuff. I mean, you mentioned Ouroboros Press. They're doing some lovely work. And as far as we're concerned, the more the better. And, of course, the Den copy of the Abomelin, that was a really nice one to see coming out as well. So.
Exactly. A lot of these obviously are coming out of various collections in museums. I know you mentioned a number of the manuscripts that you're working with here came out with the British Library. How cooperative are they, or do you even have to inform them or get their assistance to publish these things?
Yes, you do. You have to pay for the rights for reproducing any images and things, and you have to credit them for material that's in there, so you pay per image. So a book with a lot of images, you pay quite a lot of money.
So, but if you just actually get a copy of the text and transcribe it, you don't have to pay for that. You just give credit. But if you're actually using any image, you have to. Obviously, your whole book is packed full of these images of the seals and everything. So that
you pay for you pay for the rights to reproduce images, but you can transcribe text and not have to pay as long as you sort of credit them and let them know before it goes into print.
Okay. And so that's where a lot of these manuscripts are coming from, are these various libraries throughout the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just a shame that there's an awful lot of people who don't have easy access to these things. And that was another thing that inspired Stephen and I, that we wanted to make these really important source manuscripts available to people, and that's where the series was born from. That because not everyone can go and pop into the British Library at their convenience, or go up to Oxford, or go to the Bibliothèque Nationale, or go to Italy, or wherever it may be, to look at manuscripts. And for the people who want to practice magic, I think it's important that they have access to the material. And even in this internet age, this stuff is still not going to really be going on the web. These old manuscripts, you can't just sort of take them and start sticking photocopies of things left, right, and center. You're not allowed to take a camera in and start snapping at a manuscript. But it has to be said that it is a wonderful feeling to sit there and be holding Dee's copy of a manuscript in your hands and going through it, or stuff by Rudd or other people, and actually have originals and sort of sit there and transcribe stuff. It's a very enjoyable sensation.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Again, I think many, 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 many people are very appreciative of the work that you and Stephen are doing in putting these books out. I know many people who are, you know, thrilled with each one that comes out. I know I am, and I certainly want to help promote each copy or each edition as it come out. They're just wonderful. So, is there anything else that you would like the listeners to know about the books?
Not really. Just read the books and then do the magic.
All right. That sounds like great advice. Again, thanks for being on the podcast and putting out these wonderful books.
It's my pleasure.
93,
John.
I want to express my appreciation to Nikki, Keith, and David for being on the show, and to all you listeners for sticking with the podcast despite the delay. Keeping in the tradition with the previous shows, I'm going to end this one with a song. The group Kofnia was kind enough to give permission to play one of theirs, and I think their version of the Hymn of Pan from the Shapeshifter album is a great choice for today's show. I don't know about the absolute time for the next show to come out, but I assure you it will be as soon as possible. Until then, thanks again for listening to the show, and I hope you continue listening to Thelema Coast to Coast. Love is the law, love under will.
and wrestle with air that hath no boughs to nestle. My body weary of empty clasp, strong as a lion and sharp as an asp. Come, oh come, I am numb with the lonely lust of devildom. Thrust thy sword through the galling fetter, all devourer, all begetter. Give me the sign of the open eye and the token erect of thorny thigh and the word of madness and mystery. O Pan, Eo Pan, Eo Pan, Eo Pan, 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 Pan. I am a man. Do as thou wilt, as a great god can, O Pan. Snake, the eagle slashes with beak and claw. The gods withdraw, the great beasts come. Eo Pan, I am born to the death of the horn of the unicorn. I am Pan, Eo Pan, Eo Pan, Pan, Pan. I am thy mate, I am thy man. Goat of thy flock, I am gold, I am God. Flesh to thy bone, flower to thy rod. With hooves of steel, I race on the rocks through solstice stubborn to equinox. And I rave and I rape and I rip.